Here we are, 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 here we are. 95, 96, 97, 98. Here we are, here we are, here we are. 96, 97, 98. Here we are.
Trust me,
this
whole's picking up with that. That's some
must
just
be very sensitive.
Japanese ones. In fact, all of them now are Japanese and German. They're none made in America.
Yeah. Japanese are undercutting us on much.
Let's see it. Hello, 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 hello. And then it's... Hope it's working. I had a general guide called a topics for my fuzzy head. I thought we might ask just a general question to explore a little bit. That is, integration is coming in education. There's no way to avoid that conviction, I think.
Oh,
well, it's on its way.
I think it's inevitable, not only in education, but everything else.
Yes, it's inevitable. That it's the double system is not going to survive. Now, the question, what is, in your view, the role of the now Negro college, the Negro university, in this period? And in the period after the transition is made, what is the institutional function? What's its future? Yes. How can one guess about that?
You know, I wish I'd known you were going to ask me that, because I wrote an article in the Journal of Negro Education, the yearbook issue, about 3 or 4 years ago on that very same thing. And as a matter of fact, the final statement that I used was itself used by Martin Jenkins in his summary of the entire thing. And I said essentially this. At that time, it's a function of the Negro College to be a good institution like any other. Now, since our recent, should I say, social upheavals or social intensifications, as it were, I think there's a secondary role. It is to emphasize a degree of thoroughness and a breadth of perspective that it might not have had beforehand, so that it can prepare itself to be the kind of quality institution that all the other institutions are. In other words, I think, frankly, we've got to admit that we're playing catch-up. We're playing catch-up, and now it seems to me as though the distinct role of the Negro College is to reemphasize the facets of that catching-up process.
Now, do you envisage, say, within a reasonable time, the registration of white students in Negro colleges as Negro students register in the white colleges, an interpenetration.
Oh, yes.
A double track operation.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the Baton Rouge paper yesterday carried the story of a southern white girl in New Orleans who has filed suit to enter Southern University.
Yes, I saw that.
I think, though, the process is going to be slower in Louisiana because there are social factors. Now, we won't have the rapidity of movement here, I believe, that we had in a border state like West Virginia or Oklahoma or Maryland or Missouri, where we find in what was once a predominantly Negro college, we find anywhere from a third to a half, in some instances even more, of a student body being white. I think in Louisiana, as good as Southern might be, there are going to be some people who would still see it as a Negro institution, and they don't want the so-called stigma of going to a predominantly Negro college. But I think that underneath, they would admit that they can get just about as good an education as they could get in other institutions. They said, the proof of the pudding is in eating, because this young lady filed suit. Yeah, and she's not a Southerner. She's not a Crusader. She just said that she lived in the area of the Southern branch in New Orleans. Yeah. It was a good institution. However, she did say that I don't believe in segregation.
Yes, that's right.
And as I said, she's no flag waver from what we understand. Yeah, she just has an honest conviction, and she's practical-minded. She doesn't see why she should travel 5 or 6 miles to Tulane or Loyola when she can go 2 blocks to Southern.
Sure.
So I do see it that way. Yeah.
Well, I suppose, this is a supposition and a question, that the actual process will be not in terms of what you call flag waving, but in terms of actual human preferences and conveniences and needs.
Oh, I believe it. Well, West Virginia State College is a case in point. I won't call the name of the other institution, which is about 10 miles away, but I was told by a former president of West Virginia State College that the president of this other institution, obviously predominantly white one, just said, well, don't raid our student body because you have a better institution than we do, particularly in the area of natural sciences. And they're flocking there because West Virginia State College is a good school. There's good rapport between industry and the natural sciences department. So they were going to a good school and also one that would give them entree into industry where they could find good employment,
sure,
and satisfactory employment.
I see the point.
Yes.
Let me switch the subject for a moment. This is a question I've asked other people, and I've gotten a range of answers. And it's a very loaded question, you will realize immediately. Why does this resurgence, this burst of energy among Negroes, this burst of resentment, and this highly articulate and highly organized body of leadership come now? Why not say in 32?
Well, I think in the first place it's a part of a world movement. And it's a world movement for freedom and expression and for a sense of identity. And this world movement is just catching on now, and our consciousness is just beginning to awaken. And we see that we have other people who feel as we do. And these desires have always been in us. They've been latent. And this world movement, I think, has intensified our consciousness and has also given us the courage that we are a part of a whole thing.
Now, this means,
yes.
The world situation, the general breaking up of the colonial system, the rise of Africa, the rise of Asia, these things, have had a reaction on the American situation. Is that what you...
Yes, plus the fact that even in America, we're beginning now to talk about making democracy work and making democracy real. When I say the world, I would include us here. When I studied democracy, when I talked about democracy, I was pretty much using symbols. I was committing words to memory.
Yes.
But now we have Americans speaking out, saying that democracy must be a real thing. It isn't just a theory. It isn't just a faith.
Yes.
It's something that has substance in it, and that is now. So I would include this awakening of the colonial peoples outside of the United States, but I would also include this dynamism of democracy that we have internally here in the United States.
Well, another aspect of that, how much do you attribute this to the rise of a whole new generation being people anywhere from 21 to 55 or 60, you see, a whole range there, of the result of a long process of education and preparation?
Oh, I think a very significant portion. However, I would say this. I think that we have always had it. The old Negro, the new Negro, the middle Negro. But what has happened now is that it's the methodology that's different. In other words, whereas I might hesitate a bit, or you might hesitate a bit, this younger Negro now just steps right into the middle of a thing, you see. Then again, his fears are being overcome. There was a time, for example, when a Negro would see a policeman, and obviously in the South, a white policeman, and almost tremble. Well, now he looks as a policeman who is a part of his society, who has certain duties to perform. He doesn't look at the policeman as a man who wields arbitrary authority, who can shoot him or kill him at will, even though it's still being done in Mississippi and some other parts of the country. So part of it is methodology, I think. I think, but always, the Negro as a human being has had a longing to be a human being. Listen to the Negro melodies. Listen to their content. Read the history and the poetry of somebody like Harriet Tubman.
Yes,
and you'll find that there's always been this desire to be a person, this quest for identity.
Well, let's take that. It seems obvious that that is true, though it's sometimes neglected.
Yes.
But the question of the powers of organization, you see, the high degree of, you might say, intellectual mobility that you have now, the rapport, the sense of confidence, which you can find individuals before, but not as a mass, at least a large group. This is historically, this sense of the first, take the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
Now this leadership is numerous. There are hundreds of people involved in it, thousands of people involved in it. And there's a vast power of organization.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can go back to the March on Washington movement of 1942, the Phillips Randolph program.
Yes.
The program was there, but something happened to it. Mm-hmm. There was a war.
Yes, yes.
And there was a policy as I read, to not for the government, but the notice to itself to use the war in certain ways. And it was done successfully, I guess, on the whole. But the temperament is so different. The temper at the moment is so different.
Well, again, I think the Negro has seen parallels. He's seen it, for example, in labor.
Yes.
There was a time when labor, as such, I think, occupied almost the same position that the Negro, as such, occupied. But he has seen what organization has done. He has seen what intelligence has done. Mm-hmm. It's like I heard this years ago, is that there was a time when capital and labor were in conversation, and capital was on one side of the table with a well-dressed man, a Yale lawyer, Harvard lawyer, and the poor laboring man was on the other side in overalls, afraid to open his mouth. He said, but now when labor and capital meet, the two Harvard lawyers that speak to each other.
That's right.
Two Yale lawyers that speak to each other, you see.
That's right, sure. And what a maybe Jackson, the ex-captain of the Yale football.
That's right, yes.
One thing that's constantly fascinated me, I first ran across the notion long ago in reading Du Bois,
yes,
and that is the problem of the, you might say, the cultural split, to give it a tag. Yes. I even have a quote here from him. May I try that on you, though? Why should I? Because you know it as well as I do, or better, what he said. On one hand, the loyalty to the sense of being Negro, even with the sense of a continuity with an African heritage, a response to it. On the other hand, the membership in American society, in whatever degree it had been achieved at a given moment. But
go on.
On racial identity, as opposed to the sense of individual identity in a society which has been numerically and culturally defined as white.
Mm-hmm.
Now this division we see, of course, drawn dramatically with the black Muslim movement as opposed to all sorts of other attitudes which move toward integration.
Mm-hmm.
But this split of feeling, what is the difference?
I don't think that is as valid a point of view now as it might have been in the earlier days. Because, again, as I said, and again, this is one man's opinion, I think that all human beings want first, last, and always to be human beings. I don't think that they want to be, at least I know, I don't look at myself as wanting to be an African, or even necessarily an American, and maybe I hope that doesn't sound like heresy or disloyalty.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that I have more in common with human beings than I have with Negroes, than I have with Africans, than I have with Frenchmen, than I have anybody else. And I think if Du Bois wrote that then, which he did, he wrote it when we didn't have the perspectives, the world perspectives that we have now. You see, Du Bois was one of these persons who was way out in front, as we say. If you read the souls of black folk, you can see. And then there's a little bitterness in it, too, which everybody can understand. Here was Du Bois, a man who, had he not been a Negro, could have really blossomed out into true greatness.
He's a man who is trapped in his trapped in the race problem in a way.
Exactly. Also, Du Bois did feel very strongly about the African ties. I know what I'm talking about. I almost married Du Bois's daughter.
Oh, really?
We were very good friends for about 5 years. In fact, next to my own wife now, she's the only one girl that I ever to whom I ever gave an engagement ring.
Yes.
And he felt very strongly about the African heritage, but he felt just as strong about being a person. And I think now, as I said, even more than then, the Negro, like anybody else, is dominated more by human drives than he is all of these others. I think that the African relationships and the American relationships are almost 100% cultural ones, affiliations.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing that he wants is this thing that's put in him biologically, to be a human being, whatever the attributes of a human being are.
Now, how does this relate to the notion, which you encounter in many forms, that the Negro's new self-image as Negro, this notion, that as opposed to the white stereotype of Negro, as opposed to the white stereotype that defined the Negro in a way agreeable to a white man's conscience or the white man's convenience.
Mm-hmm.
And now the rise of the pride in identity, discovery of identity and pride in being a Negro. Mm-hmm. This is something that's clearly happening.
Yes, well, I think you have two or three things in there. I think that the self-image doesn't stop at I am proud that I am a Negro.
Yes.
But I think that's just one stage. You see, maybe there are three. Maybe the first one was, I'm almost ashamed. I am ashamed that I'm a Negro. I'm almost ashamed that I am a Negro. I am proud that I am a Negro. I am glad to be a human being. I would sort of stage it that way.
I see you.
In fact, I know that's my thinking about it.
Well, that's.
I don't apologize, nor am I necessarily proud. I just want my freedom to be a human being. Of course, evolutionarily, and in an evolutionary way, I don't know what I was maybe 10 million years ago.
Well, who knows?
Or what I will be. In fact, Robert Embry, whom you may remember,
of
the Rosenwald Fund, wrote a book entitled Brown America. I think this is very, very significant. The title of his book was Brown America, and this was written about 20 years ago, in which he predicted that in the next few years there wouldn't be a Negro race in terms of, mm-hmm. of the color factor.
Yeah. I read some figures, I guess it was in Fraser or Myrdal or where, not long, sometime back, that 72%, I think, or 75% of all American Negroes had white blood, something around 30%, in addition, had Indian blood.
Yes. Well, I don't know what the percentage is.
Who can know the percentage? That's close.
Yes.
These figures.
But I'm sure. I'm sure that the trend is there, or the implication is there. I think I heard. I hope I'm not wrong here. Maybe I shouldn't quote. I thought I heard Margaret Mead say once. It was either Margaret Mead or Myrdal or Boaz that there's not a pure Negro in America.
Well, you mean some exchange student arrived last week, maybe.
Yes.
Let's switch this to another matter. I read an article by Dr. Kenneth Clark some time ago on Martin Luther King's philosophy. Rather than paraphrasing, I'll read you a few sentences from it, if I may. On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect health and stability, while the black nationalists betray portray pathology and instability. A deeper analysis, however, might reveal that there is an unrealistic, if not pathological, basis in King's doctrine. Because the natural reaction to injustice and humiliation is bitterness and resentment. The form which such bitterness takes, of course, is not necessarily violent, but the corrosion of the spirit which is involved is inevitable. Here's the point. It would seem then that any demand, such as that made by kings in philosophy, that the victims of oppression should love those who oppress them, places an additional and intolerable psychological burden upon these victims and leads to psychic crackups mm-hmm. and so
yes.
forth.
Mm-hmm.
This is masochistic.
Yes.
Masochistic demand.
Yes.
Now this I found a very disturbing remark, I'll say myself.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how you respond to it.
Well, I think you've got to remember that Kenneth Clark is writing from the background of a psychologist.
Yes.
And he's looking at it in the very raw sense, if there's such a word as raw sense. And again, as you were saying a minute ago, I think we've got to see it in the light of the fact that everybody has a point of view. Gandhi had the same point of view. Jesus Christ had the same point of view. I think that if Martin Luther King's attitude is to love your enemy and to get seek to attain your objectives through nonviolent means, he's entitled to that point of view. Now, who knows whether it will work or not? I know that I think what Kenneth Clark says is true. It's, who was it, James Harvey Robinson, The Mind in the Making, referred
yeah.
to the fact that one of the great struggles of mankind is to overcome his animal ancestry.
Sure.
Well, I think that isn't only true of a Negro or an Indian, an American, but it's of anybody else. That's the reason that we have law. It's because the natural impulse when somebody does something to you is to want to strike back in the
sure.
same way,
sure. Sure.
same manner, the
sure.
same kind, if anything, with a little more of the same.
Sure. You want to win.
Yes, but again, as I said, we try to be civilized human beings, and we say, no, there's such a thing as justice, and there's such a thing as motives. Maybe he did that when he was in a heightened passion. Maybe it was not premeditated, and let's think about this thing. So that would be my reaction to that, if I'm making myself clear on it. I mean, I think fundamentally it's the same principle of Christianity. Is that the way to do it? What is the Prince of Peace? Jesus Christ said, I am the Prince of Peace. Yeah.
Well, Kenneth Clark would call that pathology, apparently.
Yes. Yes, but again, I said, if it's pathology, I guess Christianity is
pathology.
Yes,
that's the point, I guess,
yes.
right there.
And Martin Luther King, as you know, is a theologian primarily. He has his doctor's degree from Boston
yes.
in theology, and he's a preacher, and he is a Christian theologian.
I had lunch with Dr. Abernathy and some other people a couple of weeks ago, and he was answering a few questions.
Yes.
After the lunch was over, people pushed back, and someone asked him about nonviolence, mm-hmm. or the rest, about the possibility of violence in the South. Violence initiated
yeah.
by Negroes, not
yes.
violence by the Hattiesburg police or something.
Yes.
He said, no, I think that the Southern Negro is committed to the program of nonviolence, an organized program. This is the weapon, which he gave the king line.
Yes.
Of course, he's committed to that himself. He is takes the Christian Gandhian view.
Yes.
Then you know him, do you? Dr.
Yes,
Abernathy?
I know him. He's been here.
In
fact, all of them.
This sort of sly smile that comes.
Yes.
Besides, the white folks have more guns. Tactical and theological non-violence at the same time.
Oh.
He's got a wonderful humor.
Right? Yes.
One more remark from Kenneth Clark. It has been argued But the proper interpretation of King's philosophy must take into account the Christian significance and the strategic significance. This is correct for a minority of educated and philosophically sophisticated individuals among Negroes, but it is unlikely that it can be accepted by the masses. Their attempt to cope with this type of philosophical abstraction in the face of injustice could only lead to deeper and distorting conflicts and guilt.
Yes.
The same thing said again.
Yes.
All right, in the South.
Yes.
Too, he said.
Yes.
Where you have a background, a Christian background, as it were, but not in the great northern city where the secularization has gone farther.
Well, again, as I said, I think he's being consistent there when you look at the circumstances.
Yeah. There's a constant interest on my part, at least, about the present and related to the Civil War, and the North and the South aspect of this whole question. I suppose everyone agrees that the North was no more ready to make the Negro a full citizen in 65 than the South was. They were ready for certain things, but not for that,
yes,
as they clearly indicated by the course of events.
Yes.
But what effect do you think now the recognition on the part of many Negroes that the problem is not just a Southern problem? We have turmoil on this in every Northern city of any size. We have a drive for a new relationship of a Negro to his society. Now, this is not what it was, even a few years ago.
Yes.
Now, what effect would that have on, first, the Northern recognition of the Southern situation and the Southern's attitude toward the Negro in the South? Can you
tell us
about that or feel?
I think it is bringing to light something that a number of us suspected, and is making the Southern white man, many Southern white people, sort of lick their chops, as it were, to say, well, you see, we aren't the only vulnerable ones. We aren't the only guilty ones. Simultaneously, I think it's making many northern white persons search their consciences, respectively, to determine whether or not they really are liberal and whether or not they really have been thinking straight on this issue. I sensed this when I first went to New York, for example. I lived on 122nd Street, and whenever I'd go to the movie, I'd go to the movie on 125th Street, which was in those days the dividing line of Harlem, and I got a kind of preferential segregation. I was always put on the front row, the first or the second row. I would go to the one place where we could eat on 125th Street, where Negroes could eat, and there were always two highly desirable tables reserved for Negro people, and I subsequently found out that the racial prejudice was there. It was just more subtly done, and in some instances, it was a kind of a preferential thing. So I think the main thing that it is doing is to shake the conscience of everybody to say, now, am I really as honest and as fair and as good a sport as I think I am? And by the same token, I think it's going to shake the South not only into saying that you have the problem too, but it's going to make the South want to take pride and say, well, and we're going to prove to you we are the friend of the Negro by doing things that a friend would do, rather than what we've been saying. See, the South has always said that we are the best friend that the Negroes had. Well, I said that's the kind of what I call a canine courtesy, like my dog. There's nothing I wouldn't do for my dog, but don't forget you're a dog. Well, I think that the South is going to say, now, we're going to prove to the North that we are the Negro's friend by doing the things that a friend as a human being would do, rather than a friend, or things that a friend would do for a subhuman friend.
Yes. I went to this conference on nonviolence at Howard University in November.
Yes.
And at lunch, I was sitting beside a young lady named Lucy Thornton, who is a second in the Howard Law School.
Yes.
Plus standing is second. And terribly bright, and I had to speak, and she is very, very effective.
Yes.
And she's been through the mill, she's been in the jail, she's been on the line.
Yes, sir.
I had not been acquainted before. She had no idea who I was. She initiated a conversation as to how to do. She said, "I have more hope," she said, "now of a reasonable settlement in the South than I have in the North." And I said, "Where are you from?" She said, "I'm from Virginia. I was raised on a farm in Virginia." Now she's back from Birmingham,
yes,
those places.
Yes.
And I said, "Why do you have this feeling?" She said, "We have a common history. We have a shared history. We have something in common to go on." He said, "That in this shared history, there's a human recognition," wasn't the word. He said, "I'm afraid of the big abstract thing.
Yes.
Does she make any sense?"
I think she does. I think she does. I don't know if I would be as optimistic as is she, but I would say that... And again, in my opinion, that what she said was very logical. Like Lillian Smith, a few years ago, wrote something, what was it, Two Men Made a Bargain. I don't know if you saw it, but the essence of it was that the Negro and the poor white person had more in common than any other segment in the South. And if they could once realize that there was a minority top tier that was playing the two against each other and come together and fight a common battle for a common cause.
The populist movement is the
that's
only
right.
moment it might have
That's right. That we could get someplace, you see. And I think that's the kind of thing that she had in mind. The South is poor. The South has been agrarian. It's beginning to be industrialized. The South has been pretty much illiterate. It has been ignorant. And that's been pretty much true as compared with the other parts of the country for the white South as the Negro South. The only thing is the Negro South was farther down the line. Right.
It's said over and over again that the Negro solution in the South, or the solution of terms of justice for the Negro, is dependent upon what's done for the Southern white, poor white. In the same basket. I must clear the quote on that. "The Negro's plight in the South will be lightened substantially only when the plight of the poor white is lightened simultaneously."
I wouldn't say only. I would say that that would facilitate it, but I wouldn't say only.
This is quoting from Sterling Brown.
I know Dutch very well. I worked with him at Howard.
You know
yes.
him, yes. Mm-hmm. That's his essay back in What the Negro Wants, you know, 20 years ago, or almost 20 years ago.
Yes, the volume in which about 20 persons, is
yes,
that one
right,
contributed,
that's
yes.
Right. Hancock.
Yes, Rayford Logan.
And,
no, I know the volume.
Randolph, you know
yes,
the volume, of course,
yes.
So.
Uh-huh.
And then Couch's introduction.
Well, I think that is true, but it isn't the only one. I wouldn't say only. I would certainly say, because again, I think that right now, the Southern white man, most of the large numbers of the Southern white people look upon the Negro as competitor, and they foolishly realize that, again, as Lillian Smith said, that they're pretty much in the same boat, and if they get together and work, as labor is doing, we see it in labor now, very much. I mean, you find your mixed locals, and you find an independent Negro local or an independent white local, but they work together for common cause. They've forgotten that they are white or Negro. They said, "Well, we're laboring men now."
Is that true in Baton Rouge?
Yes, it's true in Baton Rouge. It is true. It's true more generally in South Louisiana, but not North Louisiana. You see, your labor
That's
unions
right.
are stronger in South Louisiana.
Yes.
South Louisiana is industrial. They are weaker in North Louisiana, and North Louisiana is primarily agrarian. It is becoming industrial, but not with the degree of acceleration as mm-hmm. is South Louisiana.
Well, it's been a shocking opening up of information about northern labor unions, the New York construction
yes,
union, and those.
Yes, yes. Well, you know how that has come about, particularly in South Louisiana, having lived here. the Negro slave just kind of went into the building trades and almost had a monopoly. For the first 4 or 5 years on this campus, I'd say 75% of the construction work was done by Negroes.
Yes.
Yes. But of course now the white people have come in, so the Negro's fight now is to hold his own in labor, you see.
Yes.
In skilled labor, that is.
Well, Louisiana has a special situation there, and a few other places in the South had a special situation.
Yes.
That was not true on the big northern cities.
Yes.
Let's cut back to Reconstruction for a moment. I remember Myrdal's plan, too late to do any good, 100 years too late. What would have been a reasonable Reconstruction in the South? And it runs something like this, if you haven't looked at it lately. He says, first, there should have been a payment for the slave. On some, or at least substantially partial basis. Second, there should have been expropriation of land to accommodate, to give a basis of life for the ex-slaves. With payment, again, to owners. Then the slave should have not been given the land, but he should, should be amortized over a long period of time at a much lower rate, but he was buying. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just given him to he was making a purchase over a long period of time at a very, you know, low rate to accommodate the traffic would bear, but he would have the responsibility of purchase. He could not sell for a number of years without permission, sometimes supervision, to keep people such land swapping, keeping people, the sharp guys from grabbing the land, sharp guys being whatever complexion you see.
Yeah.
Plus a carefully worked out educational system geared to a double system. I think is what you said. Now, geared to the immediate practical needs and to the intellectual possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the movement. Settlement of maybe on Western lands.
Mm-hmm.
And he should have said training in industrial north to a selective emigration for that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this is the sort of thing that no world's ever seen this kind of rationality.
I was about to say.
But the mere idea of it evokes so many kinds of resistances in people. It's not only it's impossible, it's happened, it didn't happen this one, it's happened another one. But does that, in a utopian way, make sense to you?
Well, it's so highly speculative, yes. It was years ago. We don't know what the attending circumstances were. It's, for example, let's take Liberia. Even Abraham Lincoln was of that thought that the best way to solve the problem was to let the Negroes go over and have a country of their own. And Liberia is having a terrible time getting on its feet. Its colonies there. Well, you have a parallel right now in Africa. Of course, the people were not slaves there. I suspect they were pretty close to it when you look at their outreach, what was really happening to them. Should Belgium get out? Should Great Britain get out? Should France get out? Should it leave a few civil servants there? Should it educate? Should it give them the land? Should it let the tribes still own the land? They seem to be happy doing that. I said, I don't know. It's so highly speculative.
It's complex, all right.
Yes, that I just don't know.
The real point, I guess, behind Myrdal's speculation is this, that there would have been some basis for cooperation as a society without the rancors on both sides that came out of the situation as it was developed, which we are still living.
Yes, yes, I thoroughly agree to that.
This strikes me as a piece of irony of history, and I will preface it by saying that Abraham Lincoln is one of my heroes. I would put Lincoln and Lee very close to the top.
Let me interrupt you to tell you
Please.
Something, if I may. I work pretty closely with the YMCA, and one of my affiliations is with the Blue Ridge Board. The YMCA has this assembly facility at Blue Ridge, North Carolina, which is about 15 to 20 miles from Asheville, very near Black Mountain. The main hall at Blue Ridge is called Robert E. Lee Hall, and you can imagine it has the columns up there about 75 feet high. And Charlie Wharton, who has just recently retired as the executive secretary for the Southern Area Council of the YMCA, called me in the middle of the day. He said, come here, Dr. Clark, I want to show you something. He said, this is the only place where you will find Grant and Lee facing each other. So sure enough, on one wall is a picture of Grant, and on the other wall is a picture of Lee. And in the background is Abraham Lincoln between the two. Go right on. I just had to share that with you.
I'm glad you did. As Lincoln's attitude on the matter of race, as well as on the matter of emancipation, we know Lincoln is a thoroughgoing racist. And chapter and verse is available over and over again. I have some on my lap. And they sound like Bilbo, a mile of Bilbo, on a straight racist line.
Yes.
In just after the Emancipation Proclamation, when a committee of Negroes called on the White House, he gave them a lecture on race.
Yes.
And necessary inequality.
Yes.
You remember that?
Yes.
Now, knowing this, then seeing the March on Washington at the Lincoln Monument, you see, and the Negro attitude, official attitude toward Lincoln. Now, what is the significance of this? Is Lincoln understood? If so, in what sense is Lincoln understood? I don't mean the uneducated Negro, but by the educated Negro. What is his role, you see, in the mind of the informed, educated Negro?
Is it in the preface or the frontispiece to the Cardinal, where the author says, in reference to Stephen Firmoil, judge him not on the basis of one or two things that he does, but on the manifest intention of his entire life? I think that statement is made in Introduction to the Cardinal. I think that our image of Lincoln is that despite these little things that he said, which the South frequently refers to, as you just mentioned, we think that the one or two big things that he did, such as issuing the Emancipation Proclamation, and the spirit that sort of exudes from these things, is sufficiently overpowering to say that he wanted justice and decency and goodness for everybody.
And his lights were different.
Yes.
I was talking to one eminent historian about the question of Lincoln's views several years ago, and he said this, but you couldn't find a man who wasn't a racist in 1862.
That's quite a thought.
And you couldn't find one.
Yes.
Where would you find him?
Yes.
Who was he?
That's
the Grimke sisters of South Carolina were about the only ones that you would locate whites.
Yes.
This is this is more important, it seems to me, that change in 100 years is a change so radical that the Emancipation Proclamation sinks into insignificance beside it.
Right.
But is it better for a Negro to recognize this process, an evolutionary process, from Lincoln to the present, rather than take Lincoln as a concealed and historical nature of the process by somehow making Lincoln a symbol for all of that?
I would say the latter, what you just mentioned.
I think it's healthier, too, rather than take it as an abstract
say the latter.
Symbol.
Oh, yes. I would say the latter, yes.
Find no shock in myself. Yeah. I would say it's part of
it isn't to me, particularly in terms of what you just said that this historian mentioned to you. It would be like, the last gubernatorial campaign in Louisiana, or I take one anywhere. I'll illustrate it this way. I remember once when Earl Long was running for governor, he said, now listen, said all of us believe in segregation. There ain't no point in talking about that. On the other hand, we never ask Earl Long for any help that he didn't make the effort to give to us. But again, what person running for office in Louisiana would come out and say, I'm for integration? In fact, I have had some politicians, if I'd call the names, you would know them, to tell me, Dr. Clark, I know what we ought to do on that. He said, but you people don't have the votes. He said, now when you get a 500,000 votes, I'll do that. He said, I'm a professional politician. I go where the votes are.
That's honest.
Yes.
That's a straight doctrine.
Yes.
That is the key, I guess.
Well, that's the reason I believe very strong in voting. I believe in the multiplicity of approaches to any problem. I'm a social problem. I mean, the vote is important. I mean, I've heard people say, oh, education will solve that. Well, I know so many people who have all kinds of degrees and honors and what have you, identified with the academic process, but I think they still are narrow in their point of view, or they haven't done this, so maybe they need some hell, maybe they need some money, maybe they need some violence, maybe they need some nonviolence, maybe they need some everything else. I mean, what do we say, that we 2/3 of our budget now is for armament. We don't expect to go to war, but if we have to go to war, we're going to go to war, you see. We're hoping we can settle these things peaceably around the conference table, but if we have to have a war, we're going to have a war, and we're going to sense a righteous war, and it's going to be a just war.
Yes. All wars are just.
Yes.
On both sides. Yeah. Do you think this is true? I've read it a dozen times, and I've had newspaper men tell me this in different parts of the South, that the segregationist mob and the segregationist leaders represent a minority.
I don't know. Again, as I said, you kind of...
But you have the opposition is not organized. It's not necessarily militant opposition. That's the, willingness to accept, you see. Accept the law and not fight. It's the law.
Right.
But the exploitation by politicians, the exploitation by emotionally unstable self-seekers of one kind or another.
Well, I believe I would accept the premise. I just don't know about whether they are the majority or the minority. Because, again, there's so many facets to it. I think, for example, a lot of people who believe in segregation, because they're ignorant. They really believe some of the stories that they hear.
Yeah.
They don't know any better.
Yeah.
I think, on the other hand, there are some who don't believe it, but who play the line, as you said, because they want to be elected to office. Just as I told you, this politician told me. He said, now, when you get a 500,000 Negro votes, I'll do that. I'll do it openly. I think as people become enlightened, I wasn't necessarily education, I guess it's, I'm distinguishing,
things,
yes. I think as people get enlightened, they will see what is best. It's like this, I'll never forget, I was taking a course in business administration in college, and I was shocked to find out that all of the dime stores were located next to each, sought to get located next to each other. And I asked the professor, why was that? He said, well, they found out that in the end, the competition is good for all of them. It makes all of them better. They all make more money. Now, that was a hard thing for me to see. I said, now, here's this man who's your competitor right next to you across the street. He's going to take your business. Well, I think the same thing is true here. There are a lot of white people who are so unenlightened that they don't realize, as Booker Washington tried to say years ago, the best way to keep the Negro in the ditch is for you to hold him down there. Well, immediately, if you're going to hold him down there, you're in the ditch too.
Yes.
You aren't getting out of the ditch. You're staying down there. Well, a number of them can't see that.
That's the story of the South, of course.
Yes.
For a long time.
Yes. So I would certainly go along with the premise, but I don't know. And even the polls themselves switch, as you know. You read the polls on a particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in reading one of the opinion poll reports day before yesterday on the switch of the public to the accommodation section of the proposed civil rights law. The majority of them favor it now, and a wholesome number of Southerners were for it. So this thing is constantly changing.
It changes, I suppose, in part for the day's news. Do you have any feeling that there'll be a conviction in the Evers case?
No, not in Mississippi. I said this is difficult for me to conceive of there being that. I've seen the Emmett Till case in Mississippi. I've seen so many that are just about parallel to this.
I went the Melton case. I was up there the day after the murder.
Yes.
Kimball, the fellow off of the Till case.
Yes.
And Kimball, who was apparently the third man in the,
yes,
in the murder of Till.
Yes. Yes.
I was in that town the next day. Talked to people all over town. I went out and saw the widow. Had a long talk with her. You know, shocking experience.
I bet it was.
Oh,
I bet that it was.
A poor girl.
Yeah.
A poor girl.
Well, as you can say, based on the history of Mississippi and the temper of the times, I have my doubts about it.
This evidence is, well, of course, there was an eyewitness to the Melton case,
yes,
the Kimball Melton case. There's no doubt.
I hope I'm wrong, because I think it would be a miscarriage of justice.
I hope you're wrong, too, but I'm pessimistic. I'm going to Jackson in a day or two.
There you are.
2 days, and I'm seeing several people there. Mm-hmm. And I'm bringing up the clock stay on.
Yes.
To see Mr. Henry in the session with him.
Yes.
And he says he will arrange for a meeting with Robert Moses.
Mm-hmm.
He will arrange for a meeting with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing some other people around. I guess I'll go to Hattiesburg, but I don't know anybody there. I know Mrs. Harvey, I mean, by correspondence, I know Mrs. Harvey.
Yes.
His husband, you see, is,
yes,
is
here on our staff.
I'm seeing her. So
yes, well, she can tell you much. She's, she can give you a perspective.
She knows the situation very well, and I'm seeing her Sunday afternoon.
Yes.
I have an appointment with her for Sunday afternoon.
Oh, yes.
So I'm hoping that she will give me some
Well, I'm sure the Clary can do it. And
I had a most charming letter from her.
Yes. Well, she's quite interested in this whole thing and many things. And she's a girl who's gotten around. Is sincere in what she's trying to do, and she's had a number of involvements. She's worked at it from the angle of the church and education and business and
yes,
what have you.
Well, she runs a business, doesn't she?
Yes,
she
does.
Involved in church.
Yes.
Affairs.
Yes.
I'm not going to keep you.
No, listen. No, that's all right.
I,
you go right on.
10 o'clock is here, and I'll ask one more question. This is a matter of speculation. Is it possible that the psychology of the Negro and the psychology of the Slough or the Southerner, whoever the Negro and the Southerner,
yeah,
you know, have a deep parallelism? The South sees himself outside, in a way, of the mainstream of American culture. Outside
it. Yes.
On many counts. Less now than in the past, but still outside. And a split also between the identification as American and identification as Southerner.
Yes.
Double identity.
Mm-hmm.
A double loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
A real hassle around that point. The Southerner also has a deep criticism of American values. And I'm not talking about criticism of the Declaration of Independence. I'm talking about a suspicion,
yes,
of the go-getterism, of the materialism of America. Now, part of it is sour grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is an honest criticism of it. It's part of being outside of the American, the big American scene. Now, with appropriate variations, it can sometimes seem that this is parallel to the Negro situation. He has his, this is going back to your put yourself very clearly on the point of this division of feeling Negro identification versus human identification, you see, on that earlier question. But at least for on the record, on the writing on the subject, in conversation, for many Negroes, the problem is there, or at least recognized as a potential problem. And the same thing, the outsideness of the mainstream American history. And the criticism of the course of American prosperity, of American values, which comes to a most eloquent statement in Baldwin's, you know, attack upon.
Yes.
All of these things are parallel to Southern attitudes.
I don't think it's quite parallel. I think the white man really is the Southern white man is the outsider. The Negro wants to get inside, but he's obstructed.
I see your point.
He's obstructed. But I think actually there is a division, there's a line between this Southerner doesn't go along, as you said, with the American complex. He really is in another world. Now, the Negro wants this thing that the American complex represents, but the fact is that there are barriers in the way of it. I don't think he feels outside, as I told you. I feel a strong identification with Americans and human beings.
Yes.
Than I do to Negro people.
Yes.
Moreover, I think again, the South itself, when it gets enlightened, as it gets enlightened, it too wants to be a part of this. We see it right here in Baton Rouge. Now, part of that, I'm sure, is a migration of say white people from the Standard Oil Company into Baton Rouge.
Yes.
You bring a new point of view,
yes.
Or from Solvay, or from Monsanto,
yes.
Chemicals, or from Shell Oil, or something like that, and they. They show this man the sheer stupidity of saying that here we are. Like, who was the man in the play that ran so long on Broadway? Was it Senator Cleghorn who said
Louisiana Purchase?
No, it was in Finian's Rainbow when he said, "With our glorious South and her sister Commonwealth, the United States forward to yesterday." You remember?
Yeah, yeah.
With our,
yeah, yeah.
Our South and her sister Commonwealth, the United States forward to yesterday. See?
Yeah, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, you remember?
Yes,
I think it said what's happening, that the Standard Oil Company is not a Baton Rouge enterprise. They don't make a single decision in Baton Rouge. Well, they begin to see that what goes on in Venezuela affects them down here. Now, there was a time when they didn't think that. It's just as they raised all this cane about federal intervention. If the federal government would take out of Louisiana the money for the welfare program or the hospitalization program or the education program, it would fall over. Louisiana would fall over on its side, you see. And I think there are some who realize that. And there are others not. So, I mean, I don't think it is quite parallel. I don't think the Negro feels that he's the outsider, if I'm making my point there. He wants to be inside, but he wants to get rid of these barriers. Like, the Negro is always for so-called federal intervention because he feels that brings him into the American scene.
Yes, yes, yes.
Excuse me, just 1 minute.
All right,
now you just turn it off.